with the Infrastructure Investment Jobs Act, with the Inflation Reduction Act, and of course, with the CHIPS Act. I would kind of call those, like, air quotes, the big three. And they're really historic in terms of just, of course, the dollar value. It's over $500 billion with a B. That really, I think, helps sort of focus us on what this transition can be.
Welcome to the Green Hour, a community of innovators, activists, and government leaders in the world of sustainability. Each week, you will hear from a leader in sustainability to help unlock your mind to a greener future. Hey guys, I'm Preston Polk, and today we're going to hear about the role of government in driving sustainability progress. This episode covers Deloitte's 2024 U.S. Public Sector CXO Sustainability Report, where CXO is a term summarizing different titles of sustainability leaders. The report outlines the roles of various CXOs in government and the progress and challenges they face in meeting sustainability goals. It also explores how policy instruments like tax incentives and key legislative acts drive green investments and impact government agencies' climate agendas. Additionally, the episode addresses challenges CXOs encounter in executing climate plans and proposes strategies for governments to advance the clean energy transition. Join us for a conversation on green policy, the government's role in advancing sustainability, and strategies to accelerate the clean energy transition on this episode of The Green Hour. The United States stands at the brink of its largest ever climate investment. Over the next decade, state and federal agencies will allocate more than $500 billion to strengthen climate resilience and transition to a low carbon future. Policies like the Inflation Reduction Act, Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, and the CHIPS and Science Act are driving unprecedented funding into climate initiatives. But how will the government strategically utilize this funding? Joining us today is Ness Parker, who leads sustainability, climate, and equity efforts for Deloitte's government and public services practice. Deloitte recently published a pioneering study on government sustainability leaders and their progress on climate action. Their survey of 435 public sector CXOs reveals that while agencies are making strides in decarbonizing operations, other sustainability goals lag due to barriers like administrative rigidity and lack of climate literacy. State and local leaders prioritize increased R&D funding, while federal leaders emphasize stakeholder engagement. With increased funding and government support, there has never been a better time for advancing climate agendas. However, we must be strategic in utilizing this funding. As Ness points out, governments have both centralized and decentralized approaches to sustainability. Deloitte's study provides valuable insights into how governments plan to allocate funding through strategic investments in personnel and infrastructure. It also reveals both progress and challenges in meeting sustainability goals. As you will hear, there is no one-size-fits-all approach to sustainability. That goes for the individual level and governments as a whole. Well, welcome back to the Green Hour. Today, we're with Ness Parker from Deloitte to talk about sustainability in government. This is a topic that we've touched on a little bit in the past on episodes, but I'm really excited to dive into some pretty cool research that Ness and our team have done pretty recently, talking about, again, sustainability inside government. So thank you so much for being here, Ness.
Preston, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be part of the Green Hour.
Yeah, so I'll say this first off, Ness, before I was introduced to you, I met a colleague of yours during Climate Week in New York City.
I was going to say, Crystal. I think we got connected through Concordia.
Yeah, exactly. So Crystal, I spoke with Crystal, I think the last day of the conference during Climate Week at Concordia. Deloitte's great. I really enjoy speaking with people from Deloitte. But then after that, after I had that episode with Crystal, I actually saw a LinkedIn post from you, Ness, near the holiday season last year, where you're actually promoting that episode. So I thank you for doing that. But that's kind of how we connected.
I recall something that I did just before the holidays was I just crowdsourced from a number of like my teammates, like, hey, what are you reading and listening to? Full disclosure, I've got, you know, some travel time to see family and whatnot. And I just felt like I had a decent list. And then I just posted it on LinkedIn in case anyone else thought it was useful. So I'm happy to be able to actually chat with you now after sort of mentioning that the podcast you did with Crystal.
Yeah. It comes full circle. And what I've learned in definitely in sustainability in this field that spans so many different industries is people that work inside this industry, we all like to work together. We like to work together. We're all fighting for a solution, which is the climate, figuring out the climate crisis. And it seems like there's a lot of full circle moments, kind of like the one that we had, again, just through a mutual connection that I'd met in New York, kind of on a whim. But Ness, I want to start off before we get into really the meat of this conversation and understand your background a little bit. I mean, right now you lead sustainability, climate, and equity efforts for Deloitte's government and public services practice. But I want to learn about you a little bit and how you got to the place you are today. So could you share a little bit? You can start off in early life, where you grew up.
Yeah, and I'm happy to share more about what we're doing at Deloitte, but just on me. So I grew up in Northern California in Sacramento, which is a state capital and it's a government town. And I actually, like from a very early age, just kind of thought I would do something in government. I just saw very early on the role government can play, in our communities and in our society, and was just, you know, kind of a public policy nerd at an early age. And I'm dating myself, but I just like loved watching The West Wing when I was in middle school and high school. And that really sort of, I think, set the trains in motion for me. And I studied political science and economics when I was in college. I did public policy in graduate school, still thinking I would go into government, and admittedly had no idea what management consulting was or what Deloitte was. But I was interviewing in a few different spots. I happened to get an offer from Deloitte to be a summer intern in Washington, D.C., and admittedly, just haven't looked back. So I have spent the majority of my career at Deloitte in consulting, always serving our public sector clients. And it has been just a ton of fun for me, again, acknowledging that I do believe that public policy has a really important role in just our everyday interactions and being able to help our government clients. I'm going to say most effectually sort of make policy, and most importantly, where the rubber hits the road, help implement policy effectually, has been admittedly how I've spent, probably almost 15 years now.
Wow. Yeah, I would say, I know we talked before this, and I think I said, what I've learned is, especially in sustainability, in the environmental movement, public policy drives the needle with everything. I mean, we're seeing that right now. And I know we're going to talk about it a little bit later with some policy, but you know, we're seeing that right now with something as simple as electric vehicles, building out infrastructure of charging stations, how that's going to really transform the whole EV movement in the US. But that happens because there's federal dollars that are being put towards that. And, you know, policy, it can help, it can hurt, but I think that policy really drives the needle with everything.
It's a ton of fun, yeah. And I think you're spot on to highlight how the federal government has a huge role, right, in incenting certain behaviors through public policy. But I personally would say, like, there's also such a big role for state governments, for city governments. And I mean, all politics at the end of the day, right, is local. So just knowing like, hey, how is that pothole getting fixed? What's going on with my garbage pickup, right? These are all really important things that all have an intersection with sustainability as well.
Yeah, I had someone in the past on the podcast. He is the Director of Public Works for the city of Atlanta. I met him at a cleanup in the Buckhead, Atlanta area. And it was interesting to hear his perspective on something like potholes, like you're talking about, you know, their strategy for really enhancing the local communities, how COVID really affected trash pickups and recycling in the city.
For sure, yeah.
So yeah, that's state government. Sometimes, you know, we think just federal, but to your point, yeah, state is so important as well. Ness, I want to get into this report that Deloitte recently published and really understand the climate leadership landscape in government. Deloitte published the 2024 U.S. Public Sector CXO Sustainability Report. Before I get into exactly what that is, I will say that in this report, CXO is standing as leaders that go by various titles, including Chief Sustainability Officer, Chief Resilience Officer, Director of Sustainable Operations, Environmental Director, and so on. These are people that, you know, have some kind of environmental sustainability title in their federal, state, and local governments. But this pioneering study that you and your team conducted, it was of 435 public sector CXOs from federal, state, and local government agencies. So I want to understand what exactly this report was and what the findings were after you interviewed and kind of conducted this research on 435 different people.
Yeah, thanks for that tee up. And actually, I appreciate too just how you opened with, you know, there are a number of ways of describing the roles and titles of people that are doing this work. And honestly, that was something that early on we were like, wait, who do we send this survey to? Because it's not as though every single government agency has a chief sustainability officer, right? It could be an environmental director, an energy director. So for simplicity, we sort of called them all sort of CXOs, right, in these positions. And as you noted, Preston, we were lucky to be able to really pioneer this survey with over 430 responses from the federal government, state government, and local government. And if I were just to sort of highlight a couple of things, I think it's fair to say there is a broad mandate that all of these leaders have, whether it's decarbonizing their operations, increasing like their agencies, I'm going to call it climate resilience, as well as climate literacy in their workforce. And then, of course, you know, something we've talked about is how do you really infuse environmental justice into so much of this? So there's a lot of findings in here. I'm happy to kind of work through each one of them. But at a broad level, there's a lot of work happening here. And this really is sort of, I'm going to say, drafting off of, as you noted, some of the historic investments the federal government has made with the Infrastructure Investment Jobs Act, with the Inflation Reduction Act, and of course, with the CHIPS Act.
Yeah, to that point, inside this report, I wrote down a note. It was actually in the executive summary. The United States is making a historic investment in bolstering climate resilience and transitioning to a low carbon future, with over $500 billion U.S. dollars slated for allocation by federal and state agencies over the next decade. And it's really talking about, you know, how do we maximize the impact of this historic investment, and how cities and governments are and local governments are bringing in these CXOs to kind of lead this transition. So I guess the first question I would ask is, you know, what are some of the responsibilities of these CXOs within government agencies?
Yeah, so it really spans so much. So whether it's anything from decarbonization to resilience to environmental justice, right? And sort of the form that takes is really robust as well as really diverse. And before I maybe get to the what, let me talk about how, because I think something you said that is really important is that I think we're beginning to see climate leadership roles, right? So for us to even be able to survey this many people, there has to be a leader in place who is hopefully empowered to do this work. But it is fair to say that that is, again, very diverse. And if I recall, I think we had about 40% of our respondents say that in their respective organizations, things were still somewhat decentralized in terms of how they were looking at climate action. And part of their job was working across various different departments and independent initiatives. Whereas I think in some other spots, we saw it was much more centralized. And no surprise, I would say, with federal government agencies and state government agencies, that sort of more centralized model was a bit more, I'm going to say, typical, with sort of that air quotes chief sustainability officer and roles and responsibilities cascading, you know, from that office.
I think there's probably benefits to both approaches, centralized and decentralized. I know for me working in the corporate world, I've worked for companies that have been more decentralized and then companies that are more centralized. And there's pros and cons to both, obviously. Totally. But in this kind of context for around the climate and environmental movement within government, what would you say the pros and cons are to both of those approaches?
Not to sort of skirt the question, but I wouldn't necessarily describe it as pros and cons, but I think it speaks to like this, I'm going to say, space where like everything around sustainability is a systems of systems approach, right? Like it can't just be whole of government. It's got to be like whole of all of us to help problem solve for this, where literally every single stakeholder has an important role to play. And I think acknowledging that and acknowledging that there is no one size fits all approach, and maybe centralized in one place makes sense, decentralized in another. But I do think at the end of the day, as you said early on, you know, there's enough momentum now on sort of what is needed in this fight. And so I think, again, we're seeing leadership really through this survey. And I think that matters, that tone from the top matters.
Breaking the quote unquote organizational silos is so important in a movement like this, getting people to collaborate together, work together. You don't have just one group over here doing something, not communicating to another group. For this to really happen, especially in the governmental space, I feel like you have to break down those organizational silos and collaborate. And you even mentioned, I think you said the word, the systems thinking approach. It's interesting because I did some research, I guess it was earlier this week or maybe last week, on circularity, which that's a whole different conversation. But with circularity, this was coming out of the Ellen MacArthur Foundation and how they approach the circular economy versus the linear economy. And really, to get to circular, you have to have this systems thinking approach. So it's so interesting that these reports are using the same kind of verbiage of systems thinking, getting everybody collaborating, going towards one, you know, one straight line system, connecting people. I think that's interesting because, again, my research is kind of delved into different topics, but it all comes back to systems thinking.
Totally. And I do think, again, it speaks to, you know, sustainability, climate action, equity. These are, you know, many would say, air quotes, wicked problems, right? And sort of a systems approach is required because honestly, if any single party or any single stakeholder could solve it, it probably would have been solved by now. So I think it's a great analog with what you're sharing with the circular economy as well.
Yeah, I wanted to add in real quick. I live a little bit north of Atlanta, Georgia, and okay. the city of Atlanta is doing a great job with a more centralized approach, I would say, to the governmental, I guess, sustainability movement. We have a chief sustainability officer, Chandra Farley, who's doing a great job. But I'm actually connected with them in more of a volunteer role. They actually have a community and partner engagement working group, and I'm helping chair this group. It's like 17 or 18 members. The city of Atlanta has a goal to transition to 100% clean energy by 2035. So this group is just of everyday people in the city of Atlanta, all different walks of life, different backgrounds, different industries they work in. But we're all working together and putting our heads together to figure out how can we get to that 2035 goal. So I think that's a good example to think about how like a local city government is working towards a goal like this. Again, I live in Atlanta. I haven't experienced a lot of other cities, but I know Chandra and the whole team in Atlanta are doing a really good job engaging the local community to find solutions.
Oh, that's awesome. And I love, Preston, to hear, obviously, this is a passion of yours and you're doing this podcast, but just hearing how you're actually like rolling up your sleeves, you know, in your local community is awesome. And I think it speaks to exactly sort of the systems approach, this sort of bridge building and movement making that's so important. I think I was looking just quickly in our report. I mean, what we're seeing across North America is these, I'm going to call them climate action plans, right? And it includes, of course, cities, also tribal leaders, other community leaders, right? It's going to take all of us. So awesome to hear how you're helping Atlanta really bring to life like your climate action plan for the city.
What I love about it so much is that the leaders that are in these positions, aren't just relying on the staff that they bring in, but they're bringing in, again, people in the community to help them understand, you know, how can we get to this? And a lot of the conversations we've had early on have been around education, been around how can we educate not only our youth, but people in the working, the current largest working class in Atlanta. So it's all very interesting. Talking about government, one of the big things right now, especially with the Biden administration, has been all of this policy that's driving green investments.
Sure.
You mentioned some of these policies in the beginning, Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS and Science Act, and the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. These are all pushing a lot of funding to build out different kinds of green investments. The first question I would ask you, Ness, on this is, you know, how can governments leverage policy instruments like tax incentives, grants, and loans to incentivize innovation, promote clean energy adoption, and address market barriers?
Perfect. Okay. So let me first maybe take us, and I'm going to go into just like public policy nerd mode. Yeah. Let me just take a step back and just like introduce, because like I also want to acknowledge as someone who works in the public sector, we love our acronyms. So let me first just say Inflation Reduction Act, right? So oftentimes called IRA, high level, right? It really sort of provides almost like a jumpstart to our country to really transition to a clean energy transition. And it really does bake in environmental justice. The other one that you mentioned, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, I like to say IIJA, I've heard others say that. And this is really about sort of the sustainable infrastructure and the investments needed across the entire country. So you'd mentioned, for example, you know, EVs, a lot of the EV funding comes from IIJA, as does hydrogen hubs, for example. And then there's also the CHIPS Act, which this is really about investing in sort of the technology and the supply chains that are going to be needed to actually make this clean energy transition. So I would kind of call those, like, air quotes, the big three. And they're really historic in terms of just, of course, the dollar value. It's over $500 billion with a B. That really, I think, helps sort of focus us on what this transition can be. Let me zero in on the Inflation Reduction Act, though, because you're asking like, hey, how do we make this real? And what does that mean, you know, for just, you know, any one of us? So one example that I love to draw on from IRA is actually, it's called Homes in HERA. And so this is where states are actually really thinking about how do you make this energy transition for individual people and think about environmental justice at the same time. So HOMES, oh gosh, it stands for Homeowner Managing, I think it's Energy Savings. And then there is HERA, which is the High Efficiency Electric Homes Rebate Act. These are important because they're actually ways of sort of taking that Inflation Reduction Act money through Department of Energy, such that states and people actually sort of see sort of how this can make change in their own home. So for the homes rebate, these are usually based on income level, with low to moderate income individuals receiving a much higher rebate. And then HERA is actually a point in sale. And again, lower income individuals will see a bigger rebate. And I think it's a great example of where you've got federal government with IRA working with state energy offices to actually help like individual residents like make changes on their homes. And just that homes in HERA dimension is like over $9 billion. So that's a lot of money to hopefully help individual homeowners sort of make this energy transition with their own home. And some of the good news, right, is that this is a really good and important thing. The reality, though, as you mentioned, this isn't all centralized. It's not all perfectly sorted. But I do think there's some good news in terms of where we've seen this play out before. I'd make the case that a lot of our state governments can use sort of the existing infrastructure that they have to, like, for example, verify income eligibility for those rebates. And we've seen that with like emergency rental assistance, which was something we saw state governments really sort of lean in and help those in that moment during the pandemic. So hopefully like a big picture of like, hey, here's like these crazy big investments that the federal government is making. What does that mean for someone? And no kidding, here's how you could use a rebate to think about updating your home for this energy transition.
Hmm. Yeah, no, thank you for breaking it down like that. I remember doing research in the past. I can't remember if it was the IRA or the IIJA, whichever one it was. But one of these policies has a section in it with funding for legacy pollution areas to help clean up these again, legacy pollution areas. I talk about this a lot on the podcast because I'm very passionate about it.
Yeah.
It's a part of my story. It's a part of, I guess, where I'm from, where I kind of grew up. I went to college in Pikeville, Kentucky, right on the edge of Eastern Kentucky and Virginia, West Virginia, that entire area. But Pikeville was known as a coal mining town. Not to get too in depth with it, but you know, Pikeville, the whole industry was coal back in the day, and that's entire people's livelihood depended on the coal industry. So when that was stripped away, these existing coal mines have just remained there, and the communities have been affected because there hasn't been another industry come in to offer jobs and employment for these people. There's also been a narcotics epidemic in these areas, again, in West Virginia, Virginia, Eastern Kentucky. But something like this in this policy to clean up legacy pollution areas would help a place like Pikeville, Kentucky, in the surrounding areas, because you have these existing coal mines that have just been sitting there. So this funding, and again, I don't know if it's been done yet, but this funding will be really helpful to help clean that up and, again, enhance the local communities that surround it, because that's just been sitting for who knows how long in those areas.
No, I'm really glad you brought that up and just like your personal connection to it, right, Preston? Because again, like all of this is deeply personal. And I think that's important to know as we're thinking about this work and what it means for our day-to-days. I actually think what you're talking about is another good example of a grant from the Inflation Reduction Act. And so I've seen it play out with CPRG, which I think it's actually Climate Pollution Reduction Grants. So this is another like really important tool. I think the grants go for anywhere between $200 and $500 million to communities exactly like you're talking about, where it's like, hey, how do we upskill? How do we think about sort of our community differently because we are trying to sort of think of becoming a net zero economy? So another nerd grant for you.
Yeah, these are all great. I'm going to have to do even more research and dive into these even more, because I know that even in these policies, you know, corporations can actually go in and apply for funding as well. I don't know how that plays out. I have no idea, so I won't talk on it. But I know that I know of some corporations that are working with some of that funding. I think definitely around energy, probably emissions reduction as well.
And I don't want to speak out of school either. I have to acknowledge Deloitte is a very large professional services organization. I sit in our consulting practice, but I have a number of colleagues that are tax professionals. And so to your point here, we're seeing with these historical investments, a lot of tax benefits as well. So you're spot on in terms of what does this mean beyond just sort of governments, right? But we're seeing industry really catalyzing around this as well, because of the tax benefits for thinking about these investments and that net zero transition.
Yeah, I know. Just on that with tax credits, I know with EVs, I think it's with new EVs, if you purchase one, you get a $7,500 tax credit, I think is what it is. I think it's in one of those policies as well. That's obviously helping, again, transition to EVs, help us to, again, transition away from internal combustion engines. I kind of want to stay here for a second on the electric vehicle discussion.
Okay.
As I was doing some research, in one of these policies, there's a good amount of funding for charging stations to build out the infrastructure across the U.S. For charging stations for EVs. And it's obviously needed because you need a power source if you're going to greatly enhance and add more EVs to the market and to the states. You're going to need more charging stations. A lot of funding is being pushed towards that. But I read this report when doing some research for this episode that said, you know, the bipartisan infrastructure law, which I think is transitioned now to being called the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, which was signed in November 2021, it included $7.5 billion for EV charging for these stations. But after 2 years, that program has only delivered 7 open charging stations with a total of 38 spots where drivers can charge their vehicles. And this was all according to a spokesperson for the Federal Highway Administration. And they said that this funding should be enough to build out 20,000 charging spots or around 5,000 stations. And this was according to an analysis from an EV policy analyst group, Atlas Public Policy. So I would just ask you the question here. We have the funding being pushed towards these things, but I'm curious as to why it's not being built. And I don't know if you have the answer to that. It's just out of curiosity.
Yeah. So classic, this is such a wicked problem, right? Where obviously the tax rebates you're talking about with EVs are an important way to get shift consumer behavior, right? But of course, it's, as you mentioned, right, it's so necessary to actually have the infrastructure so that all of us, you know, that are able to get an EV can actually like plug in and charge. I think it's definitely work in progress, right? Like there's more work to be done here. And I mean, if I go back in time, right, to sort of the 1950s when we saw a lot of investment in this country around transportation, like it didn't happen overnight, making those freeways and making those dams. And I think this is a similar moment for us where we're seeing these investments. They do take time and they do take political will, right? So each one of us making an individual choice that's maybe different in terms of how we're getting to where we need to go, as well as how different organizations, you know, make their own commitment. You know, I'll acknowledge, right, Deloitte's a huge organization. And as you can imagine, sort of we have to be really thoughtful about our own business travel and sort of what that means at the hotels we're staying at, sort of what rental cars we're using and so on and so forth. And, you know, we've made commitments to reduce our own rental car travel by 50%. 2030, for example, right? And part of that is using EVs when we're in a new city and renting a car. So again, I think there's big questions like you're asking that are important and fair, and it does take time. And I think those investments are starting to happen. It's also the individual actions as well that each company and each person makes.
Yeah, I also want to relate another personal example to one of these policies. I grew up in Dalton, Georgia, which is about an hour north of Atlanta. Dalton is commonly known as the carpet / flooring capital of the world. You have some major flooring manufacturers in this area like Shaw Industries, Mohawk Industries, and Engineered Floors. All three of the biggest players in the flooring market all in one area. These policies have opened up funding for more green jobs and actually have pushed manufacturers to come to Georgia. One that we had come to Dalton is Qcells, which is a South Korean solar panel manufacturer.
Yeah.
It's created a lot of jobs. I think that was actually in one of your reports where it was talking about Qcells. I don't think it mentioned Qcells, but it mentioned the South Korean solar manufacturer. So we have felt the benefits in Dalton, Georgia. So I can speak to that. But it's just really cool how these different policies are impacting little cities like the one that I grew up in and bringing a lot of jobs.
Totally. And like one other area I would call out, right? And I just want to say that, you know, I would not describe this energy transition as sort of a red or blue issue. So for example, Texas, which I think is honestly very synonymous with oil and gas, we're actually seeing them be a leader in the country around wind power. I think they've made over like 200 like energy related projects. I think it's like 50 billion. I think that's right. And it's almost like 30,000 jobs for Texans just in the wind energy industry. So to your point, it's really important to think about the green jobs that are being created with this transition.
I mean, to that note, I think I'll think back to our initial conversation around CXOs and kind of their roles and responsibilities. But how do these policies, how do they influence the roles and responsibilities of these people that are really driving the sustainability goals for their cities, for their states? Really, how do these policies influence these people? And I guess not only them, but trickling down to their teams as well.
So I think a couple of things here are important, right? So I would say, firstly, you know, we're talking about these sort of, I'm going to call them climate action plans. And there's a number of, I'm going to just pick on states for a minute here. I would call out, I think it's Colorado, Virginia, and Massachusetts are examples of states that have these climate action plans where they have really specific targets around a cleaner, more sustainable, I'm going to say like state, right? They're audacious goals For some of them, saying by 2030, they're going to shift to clean power by X percentage, right? Or be 100% clean energy by blank date. So I think things like that, to your point with public policy, it then cascades into both the roles that different government players have, as well as into the jobs in that community. So hopefully that answers that somewhat, Preston, with, again, sort of these public policy nudges, I think, have huge influence from just sort of a strategy to, you know, how the pothole gets fixed.
Hmm. So I guess that would lead me into my next question. And I think you kind of answered this in the beginning or kind of first segment. I mean, we know that there's a lot of funding. I mean, I think the number was $500 billion with a B, as you alluded to green investment. But how do these CXOs, these people that are leading sustainability in their areas, how do they get their hands on the money? I'm guessing it's through an application process. They have to submit probably a lot of information to get the funding. But I'm kind of curious about how that works.
Yeah. So it's I don't want to offer, I'm going to say, guidance or advice, because as you can imagine, it's so bespoke, like depending on the exact piece. But directionally, right, a lot of these federal government agencies have grant applications that state governments, that industry partners can apply to, right? And we've hit a stage with IRA and IJA where the federal government has begun to actually down select its, I'm going to say, partners for implementing a lot of this policy. So from that standpoint, yes, it is a little bit of like submit an application, but there's, of course, a lot that goes into that because it's not just always a simple click, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah. These are questions that I have just as a taxpaying citizen to understand, you know, how can we improve the city of Atlanta? How can we improve the state of Georgia? Obviously, as I mentioned, there's already jobs being created. Qcells created this facility in Dalton, and they're building, I don't know if it's complete, but they're building, it's going to be the largest solar manufacturing facility in Cartersville, Georgia, which is really cool as well. I don't know how many jobs it's bringing, but it's just great for the area. I know that Hyundai is also, I know they were building an EV plant in Georgia as well. So you have all these different manufacturers coming, bringing jobs. I like to talk a lot about, when I say sustainability, it's really bridging the economic and the environmental. And when you're able to bridge those two together, you can make big change. And
totally,
that's what these policies are bringing.
I think you're spot on. And I mean, just to underscore something we've said, but I'd say bottom line here, right, is the federal government has really stepped up with these historic investments. And now it's really incumbent on state governments, local governments, and to your point, also industry partners, where I think the action is really going to happen. And we've hit that inflection point.
We've talked about the policies pretty in depth. We've given examples. We've talked about how, you know, these CXOs can get their hands on the money, what their roles and responsibilities are. But I know that it's not always easy. And I know there's challenges that they face. Just as in any endeavor that you do in life, there's always going to be obstacles, challenges that you face. And you outline this, you and your team outline this in the report on some of these challenges that CXOs encounter in executing these climate action plans. Could you talk a little bit about what some of those challenges are and how CXOs can overcome those?
Yeah. Let me first start with, like, yes, it can be challenging, but I do think the headline is there is some good news from this report, which is that I think it was about 95% of all of the government agencies we surveyed, again, at sort of the federal, state, and local level, they've all created some type of approach to climate action. So there is something to hang all of these efforts off of. To your point, though, it is fair to say that the maturity and sort of the readiness level is diverse, right, and is wide. But it doesn't mean that there's like not good momentum already underway. I think the second thing I would share is that empowerment is really important. Half of the state government leaders that we surveyed, they told us that their agency actually had a dedicated sustainability team. And now it was about, to your point, how do they get empowered with their own budget? And that is key. But I also think what's key is that this climate action has to take root at the community level. And so that means really empowering local communities to have some authority as it relates to how these climate actions are implemented, and that the budgets are there for them to achieve those policy goals.
To that point, I would add one stat that I read in this report when talking about sustainability goals and these local state and local CXOs versus the federal CXOs. One stat that I found interesting was more than of the people surveyed, more than 50% of state and local CXOs say sustainability efforts will lower the cost of operations, which is a view shared by only 30% of federal CXOs.
Yeah.
Which is, that's a very interesting stat. When I think of sustainability, sustainability kind of correlates directly to efficiency. And as you can become more efficient in your operations, you're obviously going to reduce waste. You're going to enhance, enhance workability. I don't know if that's the right word, but efficiency can drive a lot of things. And I think sustainability, to the report's credit, shows that at the local and state area for these CXOs kind of reporting that.
No, absolutely, right? Where it speaks to sort of the systems of systems approach. And it is fair to say, right, at maybe the federal government level, there might be a little bit more momentum, right? Like they've had a minute longer to sort of think about how to actually execute on some of these historic investments. State governments now are basically catching it. And I think that's the moment we're in. And my hypothesis is that's why we sort of saw the survey results land that way.
One other piece from the survey that I wanted to hit on, there was a section, I forget where exactly in the report it was, but it was talking about, you know, what are some of the top asks of state and local CXOs versus those of the federal CXOs? And they differ. Again, as the last point we talked about, they kind of differ. And at the state and local area or government area, the report showed that increased R&D funding is one of the top asks. And for federal CXOs, it's enhanced stakeholder engagement. So I just wanted to get your perspective and view on both of these things. Again, at the local and state area with R&D funding, and then with the federal area with stakeholder engagement.
For me, I think it just, it demonstrates where we are in this movement with this historic investment. Again, I think because with the Inflation Reduction Act, right, this is from 2022, you've seen agencies like the EPA, like the Department of Energy, right, start to actually steward that funding, which is why I can imagine for them, they want to make sure they're working with the right stakeholders to help steward that investment. Mm. On the other hand, I think you're seeing state governments starting to catch that investment now, and hence why they're like, oh, we really want to make sure we've got some good R&D to accompany what we're trying to do for our citizens. I do think one thing, though, that we did find in the survey around this question is that all CXOs at all levels of government did want their government agencies to actually enhance collaboration with the private sector. So that, I think, is something consistent across all levels of government and speaks to just how it's a whole ecosystem here that's going to be needed to make this energy transition.
Kind of connecting off of that, looking at that report and that survey, and then bringing it to another report that y'all released, which was on how states can drive growth on the road to a new energy future.
Yeah.
I thought no better way to kind of segment that right now. As we've talked through these policies, we've talked to CXO's responsibilities, we've talked about how they can get their hands on the funding, we've talked about challenges, talked about what their top asks are. So now we need to understand, you know, how can governments drive this clean energy transition? We've heard everything else, but we really want to understand how they can do this. And in this report, you and your team lay out six strategies that governments can take to drive the clean energy transition. So I would love to go through these with you and understand and kind of give the listeners an understanding.
Yeah.
Because these six things could be what their governments are trying to implement right now.
Oh, well, awesome. Okay, well, I'm not going to go through all six, but I'm going to maybe try to bring it to life with a case study. And I think this case study actually hits on all six of sort of the strategies we lay out. And sort of the report is how states can drive growth on the road to a new energy future. So six strategies in there. The case study I'm going to do, since I shared that I, you know, grew up in Northern California, I'm going to pick a California example. So with that, there's a really great initiative in California called Regions Rise Together. And this was really, I'm going to say, it meant to focus new funding streams to really help the state and its residents, sort of everyone, so that everyone could really see the benefits of this green transition. I think it's fair to say, you know, for those that, you know, follow what's happening in California, there's been a huge tech boom and the epicenter was absolutely in the Bay Area. And that meant that admittedly, there is just kind of unprecedented wealth in certain areas in the Bay Area. And that did not cascade, you know, to all populations. And as the tech boom shifted, right, like different populations like felt those declines and those highs of unemployment. So I think now, as the state has been approaching this green transition, it's really trying to integrate the environmental piece that we've talked about, Preston, as well as the social goals of the state. And sort of this Regions Rise Together, I want to say it was 2018 or 2019. And they really looked to community leaders to really identify different economic opportunities, regional opportunities, local opportunities. And so that meant based on the region, things were a little different. So, you know, for example, with the Bay Area, of course, it's a tech hub. But it was also like, well, hey, how do we connect this to academia in better ways to think about the next generation of engineers that we're going to need for this green economy? Similarly, not too far away, but in Bakersfield, it was like, hey, like, how do we think about this energy transition? Acknowledging that actually they were seeing a decline in oil revenue in that area. And then, you know, keep moving along the state to sort of the Inland Empire, you've got sort of a lot of agriculture in this area. So sort of focusing on water conservation was like a key piece of what that region wanted to look at. And sort of all of that together meant that you were kind of creating this cross-stakeholder bridge across different regions, across different parts of government. You were including academia as well as the private sector. So it really sort of encouraged private sector, nonprofit, government to achieve this public mission for the entire, for several regions in California, while also, I'm going to say, acknowledging and allowing for market forces with industry partners to actually drive the pace of this transformation. And I think that's an important piece here because there were a lot of feedback loops between these regions, between these parties. And that's one of the strategies we lay out. Personally, it's my favorite with the flywheel effect. Like for anyone who's read Jim Collins, the flywheel effect is basically sort of acknowledging that you can get a lot of momentum over time. And if things are aligned properly, they can be reinforcing. And I think that's what we've seen in California with regions rising, where there's been a great flywheel effect, and it's been somewhat easy to keep it spinning in a really good way.
Yeah, when I was looking at that flywheel effect, I was thinking back, and I wrote the note down of James Clear's Atomic Habits book, talking about how 1% better every single day compounds over time, and you can really make a lot of difference by just improving 1% every day. And it's pretty crazy to think about. But yeah, flywheel effect. That I haven't read Jim Collins' book, but yeah, Atomic Habits is where my mind kind of went to.
You've got a few, and I feel like that's like one of the very good strategies.
Yeah. Well, awesomeness. I mean, this stuff it's so impactful. It's so interesting to kind of dive into what government's doing, how government looks at policy, how government applies for policy, and then how these leaders that are in these CXO roles are developing their teams, building their teams, approaching different challenges. It's also interesting because at the end of the day, I think anyone listening to this can relate because we all live in a city, we all live in a state, and we all live in if you're in the U.S., at least I should say, if you're in the country, then the federal government, what they do impacts us. So all of this relates to all of us. So it's really important for us to understand how all of this comes together.
No, so well said. And I think kind of a fair summary of what we've been talking about. Preston, I'm really grateful to sort of spend some time with you on all of this. And I mean, if I were to try to summarize a couple of things here, I think the first one would be that this is historic investment from the federal government and just acknowledging that. And I think the focus now has to be, needs to be, on state and local government as well as industry, because that's where the action is going to be. And as you acknowledge, like, that's where we all live, right? These are our communities, our neighborhoods. So it's kind of incumbent on us to really evoke, you know, this change and this transformation.
Mm. Well, Ness, I think that's a great point to leave us at. I just want to thank you so much for coming on to spending some time with me today and spending some time with all of our listeners on the Green Hour to talk about all these topics. Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, thank you. This has been a treat for me.